an alien starship with an insatiable curiosity about Earth's science fiction and fantasy trivia. The crew, two hapless astronauts who have spent their lives immersed in strange new worlds of the imagination. Now, Rob Wickings and Clive Ashenden roam the universe, trying to find the way home, seeking to define the A to Z of SFF.
Science fiction, 1950s stuff, you know, the real old school with the flying saucers and the rubber aliens, and it's all great stuff, isn't it? Let's talk about one of the best of them, the real influential stuff. Let's talk about 1954's Forbidden Planet. That's a great movie, isn't it? Let's talk about that, shall we?
Yes, let's talk about Forbidden Planet.
The planet that is forbidden. Yes, good choice this one, Curiosity. As you say, it's very much it's a classic of the genre. It's very much how would we say? It's very much a trendsetter in its way. It's very much it does a lot of things that you haven't seen before in science fiction cinema, and it's also incredibly influential.
Yes, it certainly is. I mean, it's one of these science fiction films that feels archetypal. You know, that so much has come from this seed, as it were. I mean, Curiosity said 1954. I thought it was actually 1956 when it came out.
I'm sure Curiosity's easily phased. Who knows? Maybe that was when it was initially written or something like that.
So, but yeah, this was, you know, this is when we think of 50s sci-fi, often we're thinking of B movies, we're thinking of Poverty Row productions with people wearing gorilla suits with goldfish bowls over their heads, and you know, or they have large insects in them, or and various bits and pieces. This is an MGM Technicolor extravaganza.
It is an extravaganza. It was at the time, it was the most expensive science fiction movie ever made. I mean, so it was a huge undertaking for MGM, and they just threw a ton of money at it, basically. So huge sets, really innovative special effects. They were going all out with this one. It's very much a science fiction film that you just hadn't seen before that point, for all sorts of reasons. One of which, I guess, was that it's probably the first science fiction movie to be set entirely on another planet. You know, there's no sense of sort of going out of Earth or anything like that. You're basically thrown straight into the very depths of space as Starship C, is it C-64, the name of the ship? You know, they talk about, beg pardon, C-57D. I mean, there you go. There's a name that sort of stirs the heartstrings, isn't it?
It does. And this really has that kind of golden age sci-fi short story thing written all over it, doesn't it? You know, the kind of, it feels delightfully pulp.
It does, but at the same time, it's kind of got, the plot is based on Shakespeare's The Tempest, so it's got a sense of its own importance there. The script does sort of verge towards portentousness in on occasion, shall we say.
It does, and, you know, you've got sort of quote-unquote, you know, proper thespians like Walter Pidgeon, you know, in the Prospero analogue role of Morbius. Yeah. And, yeah, but at the same time, you really see why, you know, Gene Roddenberry sort of credited this as being one of his chief inspirations for creating Star Trek.
Yeah, absolutely. He's on record as saying that, you know, he insisted on watching and rewatching Forbidden Planet, although he wanted to make it clear that you know, he wasn't absolutely copying what had been done with Forbidden Planet, but he did want to get things right that he thought had been done wrong, which I guess was, you know, things like calling your starship C-57D for a start. And but you can see the analogue there, the whole sort of the sort of naval kind of ranking system going on throughout, and that's sort of, you know, the relationship between some of the crew members is very, very Star Trek-y.
It is. What is less Star Trek-y is the fact that the crew is made up entirely of white men from America.
Indeed, yeah. So it almost feels a little bit, you know, you've got that, it's almost like someone sort of plucked the crew of a World War II submarine movie and sort of transposed them into space a little bit. It's that kind of level, isn't it?
Yeah, and you can see that in the dialogue where it's very much, you know, I notice they have an astrogator, Rob, and as someone who was the astrogator aboard the Ulysses, then I'm sure you appreciated that.
It's a tough job, man. It's not an easy job to get right, as I'm sure we're all aware of the nightmare situation we were on back on the Ulysses. But yeah, no, well, you know, I was only an astrogator fourth class, to be fair.
Yeah, and did that mean that, like in this film, you basically just had to repeat back the commands that had been given to you?
Repeat back the commands that had been given to me?
Yes, in submarine movie style.
In submarine movie style, Clive, yes.
Yes.
Yes, definitely.
All ahead two fathoms. Right. Yes, it's great, isn't it? Thankfully, we don't get too much of that on the spaceship. I mean, it's still slightly shocking to see a very young Leslie Nielsen as the captain.
Yeah.
Just because he became so incredibly known for his role as Lieutenant Frank Drebin in the police squad series and the Naked Gun movies, and you know, his work with the Zucker brothers on Airplane and so on. So it does seem. It feels odd, well, but at the same time, you know, he does that, you know, Captain Square Jaw role well.
Well, lest we forget, part of the reason that he was actually cast in Airplane and the Naked Gun in the first place was because he was so well known for this real sort of straight ahead, straight arrow kind of casting. So you know, to cast against type like that, although, you know, certainly with the early stuff, the comedy there was because it was all played so completely straight. So, yeah, that was the genius of that bit of casting. But yeah, Leslie Nielsen absolutely on point here as Captain Squarejaw.
Yes. So for those who aren't familiar with the plot of either Forbidden Planet or The Tempest,
there are differences.
There are differences. Yeah. Essentially, the crew of our Intrepid spacefaring mission go off to investigate the fact that an outer space colony basically hasn't reported back in quite a number of years, and there's concern that something might have happened to them. So they're sent on a kind of mission of mercy, and they get there to find. Well, initially they're sort of told to go away. There's nothing to see here. Go away. But they're like, we can't just do that. So grudgingly, they are allowed to land, and they find that things are strange, and there is only two people on the planet where there were this whole band of colonists, the spaceship, the Bellerophon, which is a much better name for a spaceship, I think we'll agree.
Absolutely.
Apparently has been destroyed, and the only people that are left are the scientist Morbius and his daughter, Altera.
The lovely Altera, yes, played by Anne Francis in this, in a very fetching and very short skirt. Again, you know, I can imagine there's some influence on Star Trek and in what she's wearing.
Certainly, and I say the only people, the only humans, because of course there is Robbie the Robot.
Now, again, another really influential feature of Forbidden Planet, Robbie the Robot. Brilliantly designed, again, because of the huge budget that Forbidden Planet had, this is not just a bloke in various assemblages of cardboard boxes. There's all sorts of great little antenna and flashing lights and things going on. And what you also have is a robot with a very dry sense of humour, which, again, you've never seen up to now. You know, they've been kind of like, you know, must destroy, must obey, that kind of stuff. But what you have with Robbie is something a lot drier. So, and again, sort of possibly even close to the sort of self-effacing humour that you'll see in say, C-3PO in Star Wars and things like that.
Yeah, and you also get in. They put into this is one of the first instances of a robot which has that kind of Asimovian, you know, laws built into it, so it can't injure a human.
Mm. Yeah,
you know. So and Morbius actually demonstrates this because initially, you know, the crew are wary of this technological marvel, but he says, "No, give me a gun," and so they do. And as he tries, he sort of orders Robbie to shoot the commander, but instead of him shooting him, we see marvelously animated sort of lightning bolts start to sort of arc all over his brain mechanism as he starts to short out.
Mm.
Which is what happens when he's given an order from a human, which he must obey, clashes with his prime directive.
Yeah, absolutely. So as you say, very much the sort of Asimovian first law of robotics in effect there. So, again, one of the great things about Forbidden Planet is the way it's got all these nods and nudges to your proper science fiction of the 1950s. So you know, you've got the first time you actually see a spaceship traveling faster than light, the first time you see sort of proper laser pistols being used in a sort of realistic-ish kind of a way, that kind of stuff.
Yeah, and I mean, MGM sort of special effects unit this time was pretty much non-existent, sadly, but what they did is they brought in, like, the top people over from Disney. They sort of, you know, paid Disney some money so they could have access to their best talent, which is why you got these nice ray gun effects, and also the effects when they when we actually see the visualization of the big bad, the monster that starts to attack their force fields.
Mm. Yeah, the creature from the id we're talking about here, which is this invisible monster that starts to threaten, attack the crew. And in a couple of very, very solid sequences, it actually does full-on attacks of the ship, and it's only visible when you actually fire a laser at it, or when it runs into a force screen. Again, Disney animators at hand to animate that, and it's, yeah, that, you know, with the benefit of hindsight, does look a bit cartoony now, does look a little bit Disney-esque, but there's still an awful lot of it. You know, it still feels like a threat. Let's put it like that.
Well, it does, and I think it's almost, you got to think who the audience for this is as well, because I think when you watch this film, if you watch this film as a kid, that's a scary monster.
Yeah, absolutely.
You know, and that's not just down to the animation; that's down to the sound design that they, the noise they come up with for it. especially when it's sort of in pain as it's being shot. And it also does that nice Jaws type thing of slowly building up its sort of level of threat by, you know, having you not see the monster, but having you see certain effects. I mean, this is not, they talk about, you know, crew members being literally torn apart, but obviously we don't see that. It's not, this isn't a gory movie,
no.
But, you know, just them talking about that, and then things like seeing the huge, it's a bipedal creature. So you see the huge footprints it's leaving, the depressions in the earth. And then you see the sort of the steps to the flying saucer sort of bending with the weight of this creature, and you're just sort of imagining it. And also, it seems to have come from this alien city, which we find that Morbius has discovered. Mm. And the doors are this really strange shape, which is this kind of triangular arch, which leads you to sort of, you know, conjures up pictures in your mind of what kind of bodied creatures would want that sort of that shaped door.
Mm.
So all these things build up a picture in your mind, and I think it works very well in those terms. That's the sort of exterior threat, but obviously, you know, I guess the real monster is your good old fashioned mad scientist, right?
Yeah, absolutely. Morbius is you know, he's a tricky character to get your head around, because, you know, he sort of comes across, as played by the brilliant Walter Pidgeon, as, you know, at each turn, either sort of an avuncular character or a mysterious character, or as time goes on, much, much more of a someone that's kind of gone off the edge a little bit, I suppose. And Pidgeon does a great job of kind of, you know, sort of stepping across these little boundaries and gives you a picture of, I guess what you call, yeah, the Prospero type character, the haunted scientist.
Yeah, I mean, we find out from Morbius that he's been using this apparatus that they discovered in the depths of this alien city, this kind of laboratory, I guess, is for want of a better word, which is like a brain expander, which allows them to sort of telepathically interface with the alien city and use its power to do various things. Now, the first time he did this, he blacked out for days, but then when he woke up, his brain had been sort of doubled in sort of size, or at least in capacity. I mean, he doesn't have a huge head. It's not like that. But you know, apparently his IQ had doubled. So, and now he finds he's able to sort of to do various things, and he's been using it to sort of decode the aliens' history and their science, which is how he's able to build Robbie and all these various scientific marvels. He built a defense system for his house, which is quite nice, where all these sort of automatic shutters go up in a stop motion animation type way. So there are sort of signs and wonders here. I mean, you know, on one level, this does feel very much like a Star Trek episode where they go down to the planet, investigate things, and then various red shirts die.
Mm.
Which is fine, as far as I'm concerned. It's interesting. This is like a sci-fi blockbuster, but it's so unlike anything that would come to mean, that term would come to mean later, because there's no big there aren't a lot of big action sequences apart from sort of defending the spaceship. There's a lot of build up here, and there's a lot of sort of talky scenes. As they try and sort of figure out the mystery of what happened on this planet. And also there is, you get various subplots. You get this sort of comedic subplot with Robbie the robot and a crew member who wants him to make lots of bourbon.
I enjoy that one an awful lot, actually.
Which is great fun.
Yeah.
Then there is the slightly queasy from well, even from a 21st century standpoint, but certainly in the far future, the sort of slightly queasy subtext to the Altera gets hit on by various members of the spacefaring crew who haven't seen a woman for months, and you know, Altera, she hasn't seen a man before in the flesh apart from her father, so it's this whole kind of she's naive, mm-hmm. but curious,
yeah,
and but you know, it goes has that sort of 60 thing about going around wearing sort of essentially sort of mini dresses and things, and you get this sort of nice sort of stuffy reaction from the captain about you know, you really shouldn't be wearing these things about my men, you know,
they might not be able to control themselves around you.
This sexist attitude about, because obviously that's their fault, you know, and not hers, but there we go. But yeah, so you get this whole thing about they each take it on turn to sort of try and romance her, and it's a bit, you know, it's yeah, it doesn't come across that well, does it?
No, not really, but
There we go. But eventually, you know, she decides she's in love with Captain Squarejaw. Because hey, what right thinking woman wouldn't fall for Leslie Nielsen in his spiffy uniform?
Well, exactly.
Yeah, I mean, there are some, you know, sort of nice, strange touches here. You know, the fact she's grown up on this alien world, and she seems to have this she has this telepathic bond with the wildlife there, the wildlife weirdly being sort of earth creatures which have been transplanted, so they're sort of, but it's like a strange mix. So you've got tigers, you've got western sort of deer and things. You know, and but at the same time, there doesn't appear to be that much in the way of plant life. It looks, they has that kind of Mars type landscape thing of sort of reddish brown rocks and things.
Yeah, if you see shrubbery, it's kind of shrubbery that's been sort of painted odd colours, and it all looks a bit plasticky.
Yeah, it certainly does. We can't sort of pass on without sort of nodding to the score of Forbidden Planet, which was so influential, and it's fantastic.
Yeah, extraordinary stuff. So, as written by B.B. and Lewis Barron and performed by B.B. and Lewis Barron, it's pretty much the first wholly electronically derived score for a major Hollywood movie, and it really does a fantastic job of evoking the fact that you're in an alien landscape on an alien planet, like hundreds and thousands of millions of miles away from Earth. It really does have this quite impressively eerie feel to it, and again, very influential on the sort of music that you'd start to hear in sort of filmed and TV science fiction, especially say in the 1970s. You know, there's antecedents to things like the BBC Radiophonic Workshop and that sort of feel. Obviously, Wendy Walter Carlos's work on 2001 as well. But you know, Forbidden Planet was there first, way before.
Yeah, it was, and it's very memorable, and it does sort of add to that sort of whole air of unease about it, unease in certain scenes and kind of also kind of awe and wonder in other scenes. I mean, you know, this didn't sort of just pop out, you know, in complete isolation, and it was the first of its kind. In many ways, it does feel like an archetype, but you can see that it sort of nods back to certain other films that have gone before. And it, you know, especially, I mean, when it comes to the alien city, that feel, you know, what we see of it, that looks very Metropolis-like. Mm-hmm. I think it's fair to say, or Things to Come.
Yes, very much so. Yeah. But again, it became an influence in its own right. George Lucas certainly used some of the the ideas in the Krell laboratories for the sort of canyons in the middle of the Death Star and things like that. So you see how these sort of things resonate down through the decades and get used and reused again.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, the Krell being the extinct alien race that built this city. So yeah, I mean, I guess rounding out the plot, as you mentioned, Rob, we find that the monster was actually a monster from the id, that it had been conjured out of Morbius's own subconscious by his experiments with the brain machine, and that's what killed all the other colonists off, including his wife. And Morbius realizes that this is what actually doomed the highly evolved Krell, who were kind of thought they'd evolved beyond their sort of baser animal natures, but as they started to expand their minds and sort of try and move beyond a physical form, they were let down by their subconscious hates and fears and, you know, lusts.
Filthy urges.
Yes, they're filthy urges.
So, we end up with this huge confrontation, basically, between Morbius and his filthy urges, if you like, as the creature from the id kind of starts to attack and becomes a threat both to the crew and to Morbius and to Altera. And the only fix, really, is for Morbius to effectively destroy the Krell machinery.
Before that, there is this really super tense scene where they're trying to sort of convince him, you know, talk him sort of down, make him realise that actually he is the source of it, which is where the creature is literally burning its way through all these supposedly invulnerable Krell metal doors. And it looks really good. Mm. And it's a very tense scene, because you think, you know, if it can come through these supposedly unbreakable doors, then there's nothing that's going to stand in its way, you know.
Yeah, exactly. That's the power of a father's jealous love for his daughter.
Yes, talk about those Freudian urges, right?
Just a bit, my word.
Mm. Yes, hey, this is the 50s after all.
Yeah,
so.
Absolutely. Just an incredibly influential piece of work. You kind of have to wonder what MGM were thinking to throw so much money and so many innovative techniques at a movie like Forbidden Planet. But you have to thank them for it, because it's just been such an influence on so many pieces of filmed and TV science fiction ever since, and a joyful piece of work in its own right as well.
Yeah, and you know, so successful was it that you know, we actually got a follow up film starring Robbie the Robot, the Invisible Boy,
which I haven't seen. I understand you have.
I have. I mean, it is. You know, it is a disposable piece of fluff, but it's a highly enjoyable one.
Yeah, absolutely. And then, of course, you have the musical.
The musical.
For a better word, yeah.
Quite belated musical, wasn't it?
Indeed, yes. Late 20th century, yeah. The Return to the Forbidden Planet is one of the first of the so-called jukebox musicals, which basically takes a slate of popular songs and kind of almost uses them as a base to build a story around. So that's what you have with Return to the Forbidden Planet, which is basically a chunk of different science fiction tropes thrown around, sort of various rock and roll and rock hits,
and that made sense, because, you know, very much because it, you know, Forbidden Planet had already sort of had its pop culture cachet boosted by the song Science Fiction Double Feature.
Mm-hmm.
in you know, the Rocky Horror Picture Show, where, you know, which actually, which specifically name checked it as one of the films in the said science fiction double feature. And it's just sort of, you know, the fact that that their spaceship is a flying saucer. You know, it's like you can tick off all these various 50s sci-fi things you expect in a 50s sci-fi film, but it's done kind of, you know, this is probably the biggest budget version of this, right? Mm. And it was one of the first. So, you know, and you can, and yeah, like you say, there's just so many other things are sort of taken from it. And yeah, it's just, I mean, but, you know, you can talk about things as being a classics and being, you know, being so important to the genre. But ultimately, this is just a joy. This is such a lovely, you know, fun film to watch.
Indeed, and personally, I still think it holds up. I know it's a little bit slow paced in places, but there's a lot of really interesting science fictional ideas as well. And if you can forgive the odd piece of scenery chewing from Walter Pidgeon, which frankly I always can, there's a lot to love, from the production design through to the extraordinary score, through to just the whole thing. It's just a really great piece of film science fiction, and just so ahead of its time even then that it's still perfectly acceptable to view with us 500, 600, 700 years later.
Yeah, so, you know, Forbidden Planet, it's certainly, if you have any love of science fiction at all, it's one you should check out.
Absolutely right. Yeah, two thumbs all the way up for that one. Curiosity, my little robotic friend, what do you think of our take on the classic Forbidden Planet?
Oh, guys, yes, isn't it great? What a fantastic film, and I love the creature from the ear. He's just so scary, isn't he? And just so, just so brutal. And the Krill designs are fantastic, and the whole thing is just wonderful. Yes, love it. Thank you so much. So, I think we should take a whiz out to the Altair system, because, okay, there's lots of stuff going on in Altair 4, but they forgot all about the fun things going on in Altair 3. Who thinks the Krull were only just on the one planet? Not me. Okay, so, mention time, here we go. Right, see you later. Okay, bye. Bye.
Z of SFF was written and performed by Rob Wickens and Clive Ashingham, with additional voice talents of Maria Thomas. Music and editing are by Daniil Hallow of the Creation Station of Cavishing, all the way form you can eat. Do you want to know more? Search for the A to Z of SFF on iTunes, Facebook and Twitter, or check out www.theatozofff.com.